Okay. The final Q&A, final talk. So I'll just get on with it. Okay. Ajahn. Oh, have you ever had your brain waves measured during meditation? Regular meditators and masters of meditators pass through to deeper brain waves faster than non-meditators. I don't know. I never had my brain waves measured, so I don't really know anything about this. But I think they've done experiments about it. There's a famous article about a Tibetan monk, but I just saw the heading, I didn't read the article. Ajahn, could you talk about how, as lay people, we can reconcile the concept of letting go with instances of mistreatment, abuse in our individual lives, and injustice in our society? Could a simple interpretation of letting go could lead to people not being held accountable for their actions? So yeah, letting go. You know, when we get mistreated in life, sometimes we have to look at it in a way where we can't really blame the other person for acting the way they act. It's because of their conditioning, or a lot of times how they've been raised as children. If they've had like an abusive upbringing, or how they've been treated, it sort of molds them to being a certain individual. And sometimes these people can come across, and they could basically hurt your feelings because you know, they're defensive. In their own way, you might say something to them and they're always on the defense and try to find excuses, trying to tell you off. And it's because these people are, you know, the way they are. They can't really help that. And even though I think, in a sense, you know, people try to be the best version of themselves, especially talking to some of the Buddhists that I've spoken to over the years, and they're telling me about their struggles, and they understand the Dhamma and what to do, but because of their upbringing or their conditioning, it's very hard for them to change, and they still have troubles with like being angry or having jealousy or being defensive. And you know, these people, because of who they are, they can cause like friction in relationships. So in a sense, when it comes to dealing with difficult people in our life, we can sort of try to understand where they're coming from, yeah, and have a bit of compassion and know that these people, because these people are actually struggling themselves. I mean, you talk to these people and they might lose their temper or something like that. And they carry that with them throughout the day, and they think about it and they start to feel bad about themselves. So in a sense, yes, these people are hard to deal with, but it's a lot easier for you to deal with them if you start to understand where they're coming from. And that way, you know, you're sort of letting go as well. Yes?
Take, for example, the Buddhists, say the sex abuse of children in another religion, of course, in the Buddhist case. So would the Buddhists stand the letting it go, or should we as a group seek justice in this case?
I think if you're in a position and that you can do something about it, because, you know, it's not the right thing to do. then do something about it. Yeah. If you can do something about it, then do something about it. It doesn't gel quite well in letting go, but sometimes when people are misbehaving incorrectly, if you're not doing anything about it, then the problem doesn't get fixed and they just keep on doing it, making the same mistakes. Because sometimes you have to, you have to put your foot down and take action. Yeah, there is in a sense I've been talking about letting go and that's only when, when we're practicing meditation, we try to let go because there's a time where we're giving ourselves a break from our lives. But if our lives involve taking action, if we have to do something, if we see something that's not being done correctly, then we do it. Yeah, it's sort of like in the monastery, if Ajahn Brahm sees a monk misbehaving, he lets go a lot. But if you misbehave enough times, then he will do something about it. And if you see something as gross as, recently in the paper, when a religious figure got in trouble for, sex abuse, child abuse, and if nobody did anything about it, then he'll just keep on continuing. And yeah, there comes a point where you have to use your own wisdom and understanding to know whether you should act or not. Yeah, and sometimes you have to know I think also you have to be able to be in a position to make a impact when you're acting out on something. Because sometimes, we're living in a monastery in the forest and we have these big dreams and things like that to change the world. But we may talk about it and we may want to change it, but we can't really do it because we're not in that position to make an impact. We're not part of the government, or we're not billionaires. We can't really do stuff like that. So you have to be sensible in that way as well. Yeah. Yeah, but if it's wrong, it feels wrong, you do something about it. Yeah. Ajahn, please advise on how to control our emotions like disappointments and anger, even though it's easy to control our emotions on other people out of our family. It's not so easy in controlling them with ones that are close to us. Yes, sometimes we have difficult relationships with our family, and it's just basically, I think it's just human nature. Not everybody can get along, and in times like that you just try to be nice to one another, because usually you don't really see them too often. And just understand, if it's family, I think sometimes we have this idea that we have to be close to one another. And I thought about it for a long, long time, because I don't get along with everybody in my family. And what am I supposed to do as a Buddhist? Am I supposed to try and create something more meaningful between the people that I'm not really close to? Or should I allow it to just, in a sense, just flow naturally? And you never know, in life, you may not get along with somebody at a certain stage of your life. But as you get older, things change. You might start having the same interests. And because of that, you talk a little bit more and you develop more of a meaningful relationship with one another. But sometimes, in families or with friends or the people that you work with, everybody's on a different wavelength. Some people get along with others a lot easier, and some people we don't. And that's just normal. That's natural. That's a part of life. And, as a Buddhist, we try to practice, metta, or kindness towards one another, no matter who that person is. And I always found out that if you are like genuine with your intentions, whether you get along with that person or not, they can actually feel it and understand it. Yeah? And because of that, then you'll have a good reaction, in a sense. So that way, you just keep your... In that way, you know, you don't really create any anger or ill will between one another. Is that good enough? Ajahn, could you please tell... Read the question clearly. Okay, sorry. It would be helpful. Thank you. Sorry about that. Dear Ajahn, how can be more mindful and feel safe around other people? Mainly around people that I don't feel safe around and that go against my views. I basically just answered that question. You know, like people, you don't always get along with people, like I said before. And just allow people to have their own views. You don't have to agree with them. You can just go, huh? Yep, okay. And then they just go off and you just carry on with your lives. You know, that's the problem. Sometimes we get too involved with how other people think. And when we want to, like, correct everybody's views, because we think our views are better than theirs or our views are correct, we're coming from a place of like a strong ego, we know better than other people, then that's when you start to have conflict. That's when you have... So, you know, in a sense, we just allow people to be. If they're you know, giving you their views and opinions and if they're wrong, you just allow them to be wrong. It's their own practice, it's their own karma. They have to live with it. And in a sense, you have to live with your own karma as well and how you think and what your views are. And sometimes, yeah, you may get into a heated argument, trying to change each other's views. But, you know, that's just a part of life. It's not a big deal. And just understand that these views that people have, they hold on to them and they don't want to change. And if you understand that, then it's easier for you to just live with them and with their views and opinions. Yes. And you know, feeling safe, is having that. To feel safe, you've got to have some sort of like inner confidence in yourself. And when you have that confidence, you don't really care what other people think, or you don't really care if people are trying to change you, because you know, in a sense, you sort of believe in yourself and believe in your views. So, yeah. Okay. This is my first time at a retreat. What can I do to continue my journey? Yeah, continue your journey. A lot of some good advice that I heard from other monks is try to continue on with the practice. Set aside some time during the day, maybe in the morning or in the evening. Meditate for like half an hour, 15 minutes, and just continue the practice. Do it consistently, not haphazardly. Like sometimes when some people, they just meditate, you know, every once in a while, maybe once a week or once a month. And yeah, it's good because you are doing a little bit of meditation, but I think it's better if you can find like a consistent practice and do it more on a daily basis. That way, in a sense, you can continue on and to learn about your own mind. And when it comes time to maybe dedicate yourself more to a longer retreat, like coming here for a 9-day retreat or staying in a monastery for a couple of weeks, you already put that foundation in. And when it comes to these times where you can dedicate many hours during the day, then you already set up your mind for, you know, for the meditation to go on, to flow a lot easier. Whereas if you just come to these retreats every 1 or 2 months, you can see, oh yeah, it's kind of difficult. Just because, you know, you've been busy, you haven't been meditating, and you're just carrying that momentum into the retreat. And it takes a while for the mind to unwind, to settle down. So yeah, it's always, and there's always, yes, try to keep a meditation practice, and at the same time, work on your, you know, just try to be a virtuous person. Be a little bit more kinder, volunteer your time. I'm sure there's a lot of places out there that need help. And just give without, you know, expecting anything in return. And find like a sense of purpose and joy behind it. I tell people that a monk's life, we're basically volunteers. We're basically volunteers. You know, we look after the monastery, right? We keep it clean. We maintain it. We teach meditation retreats. We try to help people out, and we do it all for free. We don't get anything for it. In a sense, we live a life as volunteers, which is a very nice thing, because you have to have a mind of giving when you want to do that kind of work. And just think about that. How can I give a little bit more? It is, you know, people out there, sometimes we're too self-centered. We don't have enough time. We're too busy. And you know, is that really bringing you that much joy and happiness? Or maybe try to just give a little bit. Find a place where you can be helpful and see, you know, what kind of quality of life that adds. And yeah, and that's what you do. Basically, you're trying to create a mind which is, you know, a little bit more lighter out in the world. Yeah? A mind which isn't so fault-finding. You're not there to judge people. You know, that's what the Buddha said. And I'm sure you've heard that as well. Do not judge another person. And yeah, and so that's what you try to do. Just make a mind which is a lot more lighter, a lot more freer. And then you are building like the foundations to successful meditation. Like a lot of meditators compare it to like putting up a building. And if you want to put up a building that lasts a long time, you have to build a strong foundation. If the foundation is weak, yes, you may come to a meditation retreat. You may get very peaceful and very calm, but because you haven't been a virtuous person, you haven't given much in your life, then as soon as you leave, that building will come crumbling down quickly because the foundation is weak. So we have to learn how to build a strong foundation. And the thing is, the people that I see that give wholeheartedly, they seem to be happy. That's what we want, right? It's a bit of happiness. Or a lot of happiness. Yeah. Bhante, when does one drop his lay name, pick up a Pali name? What is the process and what is the meaning behind Santuti? Is it smiling Ajahn? Sada, 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 three times. When does one give up one's name? I've met people that have given up their lay names as lay people, and they've taken up monastic names. I think I have, yeah, I think so, yeah. But that happens rarely. But usually for a monk, we keep our lay names as Anagarikas, and then before our ordination, we get to choose our name. And it's something for us to work towards. Yeah. So I was trying to find the Pali word for fit and slim monk, but I couldn't find it. But I couldn't find it. And then, yeah. So the reason why I chose my name, I remember I was an Anagarika and I was like looking through the books and asking other people, what's a good name? What can I choose? And then it was in the rains retreat and Ajahn started giving a talk. He gave a talk and he used the word Santuti. And he hardly ever used that word during talks. But then he said, the meaning of the word is like to be happily contented. And I thought, oh. Yeah, that sounded good. I like that. So, yeah, I was looking around and, you know, Ajahn Brahm gave a talk and he used that word. I was having a good time as an Anagarika and with my meditation. So I thought it was, you know, a fitting word to use as my name. So I chose the name. Yes, my name is Santuti, but Ajahn Brahm calls me Ajahn Toots. I don't know why he calls me that. And then that's what people call me, Tutti, sometimes Tutti Frutti. And my nieces and nephews calls me Uncle Tutti. So yeah. But yeah, that's how I came up with my name. And in some monasteries that you go to, the teachers, they choose your name. And yeah. So it just really depends where you're ordained. Dear Ajahn, I have a job. What does that mean? That's it. I have a job. I don't know. Okay, can you do a 5-day retreat like Ajahn Khema has done in the past? 9 days is very difficult for parents with young children. 5 days would be wonderful. Ooh, 5 days. Do you want me to do a 5-day retreat? I don't know if I can do 5 days, but I don't know. I didn't ask to teach this retreat because usually the BSWA they organize it, and if they're looking for somebody to teach, then they'll ask them. But yeah. I have no inclination to organize one, but if you guys want to organize it and invite me, then I'll come along and teach it. Yeah, so it's really up to you. Yeah. What would you suggest to teach or encourage children or grandchildren to practice a more mindful life? I don't know, way. I think with kids, yeah, I'm surrounded by kids sometimes. When I go home and visit my family, my uncles and my aunties, they have like 2 or 3 children, and I have like 10 or 15, 10 aunties and 10 uncles and about five cousins and they have kids and they're all growing up now, like in their young teens or 8, 6 or 4. And sometimes you look at them and think, you know, how can you train a child or how is that child being treated, you know, by their parents? And I think, you know, with children, they learn more from how a parent, you know, acts around them, how the parents talk to the kid, and how the parents treat the child. And it's sometimes sad to see that you sometimes see parents yelling at their children and try to get the point across because they're doing something wrong. And if you watch the children over the years, they start to develop those kinds of qualities, the same qualities as their parents. So when they get into their teens, when their parents are trying to discipline them, they're trying to tell them something, because the kid has learnt it from a very young age, to argue, to shout back, then they start having arguments. And why is that? It's because the kids have learnt that from their parents. Not through the parents teaching them, but just by how the parents have been acting, how they speak to the child. And sometimes when you think about it, you can't really take a child aside, you know, 4 or 5 year old, and start talking about the Dhamma. This is how it is to be mindful. This is how it is to practice metta meditation. They might go, okay, but they're not going to understand. So in a sense, they learn more in how we act and how we speak to them. So I think if you want your child to learn more about metta or loving kindness, you have to be kind yourself. You know, how do you speak to your child? Are you showing your child any kindness? And I think if you can do that, you're actually teaching them, you know, through actions and through your own words. And if you live life mindfully as a parent, you do things carefully, then the child, they pick that up too. The children are copycats of their parents. Yeah, so when people see me and my mother, we're very similar. It's not because, and I think one of the reasons is because we copy, you know, our parents when we're growing up. So yeah, in a sense, it is hard to teach children, I think, formally, but it's a lot better if we can set the right example. And it's actually good practice for us. Yes, sometimes we think we know better as parents, but we have to look at our own actions. How do we talk to them? And if we can't correct ourselves, you know, how do we think we can correct even our kids? Yeah. And it is sad to see, because the way some kids are being brought up, and you know, with all the shouting and all that kind of stuff, not just happening when they're like 2 or 3 years old, but just going on into their teens and, you know, 14, 15, you can imagine what kind of impact that has on a person's mind. And it's not a very healthy upbringing. Yeah. So yeah, you got to be careful. You don't really need to teach them formally, take them to the monk. You just set the right example. And they will learn that way. Yep. Okay. That's it. Any other questions? Comments? No? Okay. Yes.
Earlier in this metta meditation session, you told us the story of this mother and child and two apples. And it brought me back memories of my own mother.
Yeah.
She's been long gone.
Yeah. Sorry?
I remember receiving metta
from her. Yeah.
How does one, like, repay send metta back to her, someone who has long passed away? Or how do you send, another question would be, do you send metta to departed relatives or friends?
I think wishing them well, respecting their memory. Because, in a sense, you may be able to you want to like send them metta, but they're not around, and as a Buddhist they've moved on. Maybe to in the heaven realms or another human being. So if you're real about it, you can't really like send metta towards your mother, but you can always I've lost my father, but I was never really close to him. But I guess if you were close to your mother, then you can just rejoice in the wonderful memories that you've had with her and the things that she's done for you. Yeah. Because, if it's somebody that you, were really close to and that gave you a lot of love and you love her a lot back, yeah, she may be gone, but you can always like remember her, I think, in a good way, and allow that to, bring you some happiness. Yeah. Knowing that, there's really good people out there. Yeah. It's really hard. I don't really know. But yeah. Any other questions? Yes?
Oh. How about attainment of this stream enter? How to get there?
Become a monk first. Become a monk. meditate, get the deep jhanas, and then stream winning will happen. It's like Ajahn Brahm would always say, like in the Dhammapada, you need the teachings of the Buddha, and you need the deep meditations to be able to achieve these higher states, which are taught in Buddhism. But for myself, I don't really think about stuff like that, because there's no point really. In a sense, that there are these stages that may be attained. But if you still think about them and want them, in a sense, that's a blockage to make any progress. So I try not to think about it. Well, I don't really think about it at all. But I think about it in terms of, it would be nice to become a stream enterer. if you think about it, if any attainment that you want to attain, that's probably the best one. Because that you're on the path to becoming fully enlightened, but before that, you're still in a sense being swayed by your karma. A stream enterer is a person, when they get reborn, they're always going to get reborn in a wholesome realm, like the human realm, the deva realm. They cannot be reborn in like the lower realms. So in a sense, they are safe. They are in a sense safe. Yeah. So that's what I think as a person. If I'm going to attain something, that's what I hope for. Then after that, you don't really need to worry about anything. And that's how Sariputta taught as well. And you had Sariputta and you had Moggallana. And Moggallana would train these monks until they became like arahants. But Sariputta being the one whose strength was wisdom, he understood that if they become a stream enterer, then from that point afterwards, the path is automatic, and eventually they will become arahants. Yeah. So like I said, yeah. So, it's, how do you become a stream enterer? You, uh, You know, you just be a virtuous person, practice meditation, contemplate the Dhamma, and you just keep on doing that and doing that and doing that. And really, you know, Ajahn Brahm, he emphasizes needing, a person needs the deep meditations, like the jhanas, to be able to have, a clear enough mind to see, you know, what is actually going on, to be able to develop insight. And only once you have that kind of mind, that's when the attainments happen. And it is true, you can't think your way to Nibbana. Yeah. It's more of a stilling process, more of a letting go process towards Nibbana. Yeah. Question? Yeah, else?
During one of the talks, you sort of mentioned, I can't remember how you said it, but it was really, it's just a lovely way of sort of saying,
okay, yeah.
Waking up and you'll go, oh no, I can't. But it was,
that's all right.
Like waking up and just sort of going, oh, this is a good life. And having a feeling of almost, I got a sense almost like just not having any blame in your mind, just feeling glad to have the life that you have and not seeking anything more from it, sort of thing.
Yeah.
But it's really lovely. But I was wondering how that made me sort of feel or wonder about the relationship between that and the path. So virtue,
stillness,
and wisdom. That felt to me like the steps on that path. I was just wondering
if you could talk more
about that sort of sense of
where it is, what step it is on the path.
Yeah, or just how that informs or is part of the path.
It's, you know, when I'm thinking about it now, the reason why you feel good when you say, you know, life is good when you wake up and everything seems to be okay, and then you look at your mind and you see, you can ask yourself, why is it the way it is? And I think one of the reasons is because as a person, you're not fault-finding. Yeah, you're not fault-finding, you sort of analyze people, but you're not fault-finding. So you know a person's character, you know, what they're like. And, you know, if they're like, if they have too many views and opinions or, you know, if they're a kind person. So you use that, use that fault-finding mind not to be negative, but to understand other people. So, because sometimes, you know, when you have a fault-finding mind and you're blaming that person, then it sticks in the head. Yeah, it sticks. So, you know, you start thinking about them, you start blaming them, and this is the reasons why they're this type of person. So, you know, when I look at the mind, you know, the reason why it feels good is because it doesn't have a fault-finding mind. It's not blaming people. So, that's one of the contributing factors. And another factor is the reason why you feel good is because you don't really carry things around. You do your business, and then you just get on with your life, yeah? So when you do your work, you do your work, and when you come home, you just leave work at work. And now it's time to be at home. If you have a family, look after your family. And another contributing factor to give you that sense of well-being is to be kind to other people. You know, I live in a very small community, and I always like to say that a small community is sort of like living in a small boat, right? You're living in a small boat. If one person rocks the boat, everybody feels it. And living in a big community like Bodhinyana Monastery is like a ship, basically. If one person rocks it, you don't really feel it. So when you're living in a small community, you got to be careful when it comes to treating other people. So what you do is you just treat them with kindness. And that way it creates more harmony with one another. So, yeah, to get to that point where you start feeling good about yourself, you start to notice that there isn't too many troubling thoughts in your mind. You know, you still do you still do the things that you enjoy doing. You know, even as a monk, you have things that you like to do. I like plants. Yeah, I like plants. So, you know, I've got some pot plants and, you know, I look after them. And, you know, it's harmless. And then you learn about them so you can grow them in a certain way so they look nice. And, you know, you do things like that. Things which things which don't really burden your mind. And another thing as well is, if you can, just develop a little bit of peace in your lives, you know, that sense of calm. So you can just, you know, bring it up when you need to. When you're like walking in the streets and you're by yourself and there's nothing going on, you can just go back to that place of calm. And that sort of gives you that feeling of being a more even-minded person, you know, being a person who's having a good day, every day, kind of thing. Yeah. So yeah, it's a lot of things that happen and contribute to your, you know, happiness and your well-being, yeah. And yeah. It's just, it happens slowly, but it does eventually happen. And the other thing is also being mindful, like I said before. Ajahn Chah mentioned being mindful as one of the most important factors of the meditation path. And I think one of the reasons why mindful is so important is because it just gives you that little bit more clarity of mind. When your mind is clear, it's not muddy, things aren't, you know, it's not being dragged down by worries and problems, and in a sense you're more like, you could say, addicted to being mindful, addicted to being in the moment, addicted to having nothing in your mind, not nothing but less in your mind. You know, I still have stuff in my mind, Ajahn Brahm still has stuff in his mind, because he, you know, obviously he has to do things, you have to think, but there are moments when you look at Ajahn Brahm, he's like, you can see it in his eyes, he's very sharp. Like, there's something, there's like a 14,000 watt light bulb behind those eyes, you know, there's some sort of brightness there, sharpness. Yeah. Yeah. You had a question? Yeah.
Thank you very much for sharing.
No problem.
You're a very natural teacher.
I'd love to. Okay, who else wants to come along? No, is that all? No, I'm just kidding. Okay, we can finish up. Yeah. I just encourage you to just do what you can to, you know, like, your mind is something precious, and we have the opportunity to make, I think, changes, to become better people, to become a little bit more calmer, a little bit more wiser. And yeah, I just remember this one guy telling me he used to have a high position and he would use anger and fear to control people. And he thought that he couldn't change as a person, but then he came across, you know, good monks and good teachings of the Dhamma, and he actually started to implement that in his life. And instead of like controlling people out of fear and anger, he started using, you know, more kindness and you know, more metta in terms of how to encourage other people to do the work. And he thought that he wasn't able to do that kind of thing, to be able to make that change. So, you know, I'm just telling you that because I've met people in my life that tell me that they cannot change. You know, they are the person they are, and they can't make that change. You know, they try to meditate, but they say, I can't change. But the truth is, you can. And if you can take that, you know, idea that you can change as a human being, then you can sort of make the changes that you need in life to make the progress along this path, to become, you know, more wise, more happier, more peaceful people. Okay. Finito. I'll be up here for a little while. If you want to come up for a chat, you can. We just bow to the Buddha.